will call the docket.
Miguel Antonio Reyes against the Commonwealth of Virginia. Catherine C. Donahue, Senior Assistant Public Defender for the Appellant. Mark R. Herring, Attorney General, Christopher P. Shanville, Assistant Attorney General for the Appellate.
You may proceed.
May it please the Court, Catherine Donahue from the Fairfax Public Defender's Office on behalf of Mr. Reyes. I would like to request 5 minutes for rebuttal, please.
All right.
In this case, the Court of Appeals erred by not applying its plain language analysis to the determination of whether the continuance should have been granted in this case. Instead, the Court of Appeals read a requirement into the statute that the General Assembly did not see fit to write into the statute, namely that Mr. Reyes demonstrate exceptional circumstances for the last-minute continuance request.
What if that had not been the case? What if the Court had assumed that the continuance is something that has to be reasonable, not so much exceptional, but at least reasonable? Would that have been an appropriate interpretation?
No. The reason for that is because reasonable, as used in this statute, was referring to the length of time of the continuance, not whether it was appropriate. And we know that from the mandatory language used throughout the statute and the triggering requirements to get that continuance.
So let's test out that thesis. Suppose an attorney is retained 10 minutes before jury trial that's been sitting on the docket for 6 months. And it's a legitimate retainer. And the court-appointed attorney is ready to stand down, but nonetheless ready to try the case. And the retained attorney says, I'm here under 19.2, 159.1, and I want a continuance. I have an absolute right to a continuance. And the judge says, well, why? And the attorney says, well, I'm just not feeling it. And the judge says, well, are you prepared to go forward? Can you take the case over? He says, yeah, I can take the case over. I just don't want to. I've got a Starbucks date this afternoon. And the judge says, so that's your excuse? And the response is, I don't need any reason or no reason or a good reason or a reasonable reason. I have an absolute, indefeasible right to a continuance. Now, why is that a no extreme example not permissible under your interpretation of the statute?
I think for several reasons. And obviously, the court does have concerns with gamesmanship in the trial process. But the way that this statute is written, it doesn't just require a continuance. If there is an indigent defendant, and of course this only applies when there's an indigent defendant who has a change of circumstances requesting a continuance.
My hypothetical is a privately retained attorney is privately retained and ready to go 10 minutes before the trial starts.
Yes, assuming that defendant is indigent beforehand, and this new retained counsel is coming into the case. The statute also provides that when private counsel has been retained, appointed counsel shall forthwith be relieved of further responsibility. And so the statute doesn't just talk about necessitating a continuance once there has been a change of circumstances and the forthwith advisement to the court of that. It also talks about the fact that once that change of circumstances has occurred, court-appointed counsel shall forthwith be relieved of their responsibilities as well. And so
I think you're answering my question, but I don't know if you're following why I've asked it. It sounds like to me the logic of your argument is, under the scenario I just gave you, there is an indefeasible right, not subject to prejudice, not subject to harmless error, not subject to any normal doctrines of appellate review. It's like a structural right, statutory structural right, to a continuance, even though there's conceitedly no reason for it. And the attorney, the privately retained attorney, under your logic, could say, I don't need a reason. And it doesn't have to be reasonable even if I had one. Now, am I exaggerating? Obviously, the fact pattern is exaggerated, but tell me why what I'm saying is inconsistent with your interpretation of the statute.
I don't know that it is inconsistent. That might be the very worst case scenario. But what is important is that in order for this statute to apply, there are several things that have to occur first.
All that's conceded in what I'm asking you.
Then in this situation, if that retained counsel is seeking a continuance to prepare for trial.
That's interesting. So it has to be reasonable from the point of view of I need a continuance in order to get ready for trial.
The statute speaks to the fact that the continuance shall be granted to allow counsel to be obtained. In your scenario, he's been retained at this point, and to prepare for trial. And so that would have to be the proffered reason for the continuance. But at that point, it would then go to how far out should the court continue the matter.
Okay, so don't let me put words in your mouth, but it sounds like you're implying what I'm implying, which is the statute obviously requires a reason, not just no reason, and it's got to be a reasonable reason, and the reason obviously is to get ready. You can't show up at the last second and wing it. So in that scenario, if someone said, well, I'm actually prepared to go forward, or if you want to, if you deny me, the court-appointed counsel is perfectly prepared to go forward, then there would be no right to a continuance because the reason for it doesn't exist.
If the retained counsel is requesting the continuance to prepare, then the statute mandates that it be granted. If retained counsel does not see fit to request that continuance, then there's no issue.
But the record in this case makes it pretty clear that the reason was that the counsel wanted to file a motion to set aside the plea.
Yes, and to prepare for sentencing because he was not prepared to move forward with Mr. Reyes that day.
So, counsel, let's presume for purposes of this question that there was an abuse of discretion by the judge. What very specifically is the harm to the appellant?
The prejudice, Your Honor?
Yes.
So the prejudice in this case, and this is where we are guided by the Sixth Amendment cases that follow.
Is this a Sixth Amendment case?
It's not.
This is a statutory case.
This is a statutory case, but if we're looking at prejudice, cases inform us on how we're supposed to analyze that when there's been a denial of counsel.
Okay.
And it's difficult to describe the consequences that flow from the erroneous deprivation of counsel.
But he's never been without counsel.
Yeah.
Of his choosing. And in this case...
Well, you don't have a right to counsel of your choosing when you're indigent.
Yeah, what he said.
If the court is looking at the specific prejudice suffered by Mr. Reyes here, we can look to Mr. Nord's concessions at a later hearing where he conceded he did not adequately prepare and investigate this underlying case. And we know that's true from the actual sentencing hearing because Mr. Reyes, during his allocution, was not prepared. He didn't believe that they would be moving forward with sentencing that day. Mr. Nord conceded that he never requested funds for an investigator, failed to look into the specific allegation about the alibi defense, and waited months after the fact to even begin that search. He tried to correct some of these errors through filing post-trial motions, but as the court can see from the record, the very first motion that was filed was devoid of any legal analysis as to why he should be permitted to withdraw the plea. And the second motion that was filed was well past the 21-day period that the court had the ability to consider that issue. So,
I'm sorry. Yeah. Please complete your answer. I just had a question. If you have completed your answer,
that would just be specific examples of the prejudice that was demonstrated by the denial of the continuance and moving forward with Mr. Nordis counsel.
My question is this: the parties don't focus on it, but am I correct? It's the defendant's family that was able to gather up the funds and retain Mr. Swedish.
Yes.
Right? Okay. The plain language of the statute is, in the event the defendant undergoes a change of circumstances. So I understand that the defendant is incarcerated, he's indigent, hasn't won the lottery, gotten any kind of inheritance or job. So he's still, his financial circumstances have not changed at all. Is that right? So I'm just trying to figure out why, with a statute that's designed essentially to protect the public fisc. I mean, it's not designed to provide any kind of enhanced right to the defendant particularly. Why it applies at all when the family retained a new lawyer for him, but the threshold condition of the defendant having a change of financial circumstances just doesn't apply. What am I missing?
So the change of circumstances here is exactly what Your Honor pointed out. The change comes from his family's willingness to contribute to his defense. And that...
But the phrase is, the defendant undergoes a change of circumstances so that he's no longer indigent. So what that says to me is, in a situation, let's say the defendant's out on bail, he finds a job as a whatever, and now he has a paycheck. Well, why is the taxpayer going to supply him with a court-appointed attorney when he's able to pay his own? Or he gets an inheritance. Now he has a pot of money. He can retain a lawyer. This is different. This is the family gathering up the money. But under the plain language of the statute, he's still indigent.
In determination of whether or not a defendant is indigent, there are several things that factor into that analysis, including gifts. And so if the court is looking at how money provided to a defendant through his family could change his circumstances so he's no longer indigent, it could presumably be considered
okay, a gift. So if the family writes him a check and deposits it in the inmate account, here's $100,000. All right. But that's not what we have.
There is certainly an argument to be made that while this is a statutory case, there has been a blending of the statute and the constitutional framework here. And our appellate courts and the Court of Appeals specifically has held that in the constitutional realm, the right to counsel does include the ability of a person to provide counsel for himself by his own resources or through the aid of his family or friends. And that comes from Paris versus Commonwealth.
But it seems then we have the paradox of we want to mash together this constitutional and statutory provision, but then we want to resist the Court of Appeals application of the exceptional circumstances. So why would that not be appropriate if, in fact, we're now going to draw from the well of constitutional cases?
Because the change of circumstances here speaks to the Commonwealth's interest in not paying for court-appointed counsel for someone who can afford it. And so that is the specific change of circumstances here. Even though it's not by his own ability to go out into the community because he is incarcerated, he's able to solicit that change through the contributions of his family.
Under your interpretation of this statute, would the court give any consideration to the normal considerations of a continuance, prejudice to the Commonwealth, inconvenience to witnesses? Would the court give any consideration to any factor other than retained counsel requesting a continuance to prepare for trial?
That would certainly factor into how far the case should be continued to. And again, that
would... But the initial determination of whether to continue at all.
In the specific instance where an indigent defendant retains counsel, it would be an automatic continuance without interest in the harm it would cause to the Commonwealth. That would play into the analysis of how far out to continue it under the reasonable language.
Well, then, so just do you agree that this statute appears to be primarily intended to prepare to protect the public risk rather than any particular defendant?
I think based on its situation in the chapter and article in which dealing with indigent defendants, this reflects the Commonwealth's interest in not paying for an attorney for someone who can afford their own.
And with that established, to what extent does that inform our analysis about the appropriate remedy?
The other effect of this statute in a situation like this one, where it is made on a day before the day of the sentencing hearing, means that there will be some inconvenience possibly to the Commonwealth. Here it was only one witness who was present to testify. Other than that, there really was no inconvenience to the Commonwealth in this case.
The problem with that argument is it makes this statutory right that you're relying upon like a super right, a uber right, more important than a speedy trial right, more important than Miranda, more important exclusionary rule. Because in every situation where there is an alleged violation of a shall command, either in the Constitution or in the statute, appellate review takes into account what factors should be considered for the remedy of that. And it's just a non sequitur. We hear it all the time that because you have a right, you necessarily have the most extreme remedy on the table. And here it is, I have a right to a vacature of everything that happened below. Because I could have walked in that day and just said, I have a Starbucks date, and I need a continuance for that. And I don't want, again, don't put words in your mouth, but I think your logic would say, well, he doesn't have to even answer the question, Judge. He doesn't have to give a reason at all, much less a Starbucks reason. Could that possibly be what the legislature intended?
That's why there are the other requirements in the statute that the trial court has to be satisfied have been met, that the change of circumstances was alerted to the trial court forthwith, albeit immediately, and that there was no unnecessary delay in bringing that request to the court. And so that is a sort of built-in safeguard to prevent instances of gamesmanship.
One last question. The trial judge here was apparently trying to work with the problem. It didn't appear to me from reading the transcript the trial judge was doing a whole lot of proactivity here, just trying to work the problem out. And so at some point, there was a back and forth. I'm not suggesting my question is the outright waiver, but there was a back and forth where it seemed to be the trial judge was thinking, okay, I'll figure out the problems you're talking about on the motion reconsider stage. I promise you, I'll look at it. I'll give it a hard look. I'm not going to blow it off. And there's a invisible handshake on that point. Okay, I would rather do what I want to do, but that works for me. And I know that would violate your shall mean shall mean shall mean shall, and you get the highest possible remedy in theory logic. But would it violate the idea of just simple prejudice if the trial judge really did give a hard look and made a reasonable decision on the motion to not vacate the plea? Where's the prejudice?
Your Honor, I see that.
Yeah, you go ahead and answer the question. I have one, too, after that.
Yes, Your Honor. So if I understand Your Honor's question correctly, and I'm not sure that I do.
Is there a waiver argument without it being a strict waiver argument?
I don't believe so. So I know the Commonwealth raised the issue of waiver, and I dispute that this issue is waived, given that the trial court said at the end, at the ruling, given the Commonwealth's objection, this argument is waived. But for a prejudice analysis, at the end of the day, even if the trial court invited subsequent filings, the fact of the matter is those filings were never submitted to the trial court in proper form with proper legal argument and
but
fact.
That's not the trial court's problem. That's the defendant's problem. Maybe he should bring a habeas.
But that has to play into the prejudice analysis. If we're talking about what is the prejudice to Mr. Reyes for not moving forward.
The trial judge doesn't know that at the time he denies the continuance. He doesn't know it's going to be a lousy motion to reconsider. He just knows he's given an opportunity for one to be filed.
Again, even filing a motion to reconsider doesn't go back and undo what could have occurred at an actual sentencing hearing when the court has the full plethora of facts and options available to it, and not a statute with a separate requirement of how he must find an order for a reconsideration to be granted in the first place.
Thank you.
Ms. Donahue, we all know that you were not counsel in the trial court when all of this was going on. We know that. We appreciate you being here. But I have a question for you. If, in fact, there are changes of circumstances, this is a follow-up to Justice McCullough's line of argument or questioning, if there has been a change of circumstances, why are you here from the Office of the Public Defender?
When the delayed appeal was granted by the Court of Appeals, the order from the Court of Appeals required the trial court to appoint counsel.
Well, I know, but it's the same defendant, right?
It is the same defendant.
And he's the one who is swearing that his circumstances have changed and that he does not need the Commonwealth of Virginia to pay for his lawyer. So why are you here?
That's looking at it in a vacuum. The delayed appeal was obviously filed and granted many months after Mr. Swedish stood before the court and said this money was available. There's no way to know that that money, that gift, is still available to Mr. Reyes. And so I don't think the fact that he now stands before the court with court-appointed counsel, when we also know that appellate cases take on much more complexity and therefore require sometimes...
Well, they might, but it goes back to what Justice McCullough was asking you. Where is the focus? You know, when this issue came up at the trial court, was the defendant still indigent nonetheless? And he had a different source, somebody, a benevolent source who was going to pay. And isn't that the same now? He's always been indigent. Always. And the fact that you're here, I think in many strange ways, demonstrates that.
I think the fact of the matter is that by his continuous incarceration, Mr. Reyes would have a difficult time to demonstrate that there's been a personal change in his circumstances. He's not able to work. He's not able to get a job. But back in 2016, in July, when Mr. Swedish motioned the court, there was a change at that time. That change no longer exists, obviously.
All right. Well, it just seems very odd to me, but your explanation has been heard.
Can I ask,
sure.
How do we put the jack back in the box? I mean, it sounds like to me, even if we give the relief that you're asking, he'd go down, he'd have the same lawyer he had before, a court-appointed lawyer, and then we go back through the same thing that's already happened.
That is the request that we're seeking. What will happen from that point forward We'll have to see if Mr. Reyes can retain Mr. Swedish again. That may be very well what he intends to do. But again, we're about 2.5 years down the road, so I think it's speculative to say how he would proceed, but it would entitle him, in our opinion, to a new sentencing proceeding.
All right. Well, thank you very much. As often is the case, the court has taken your time.
Yes. Thank you very much.
Good morning, Your Honors, Mr. Chief Justice, and may it please the Court, Chris Chandeville on behalf of the Commonwealth. In this appeal, Mr. Reyes argues that he was entitled under the statute to a mandatory continuance of his sentencing hearing, and he argues that the appropriate remedy, the only remedy that this Court should give him, is for the Court to vacate his sentence and return the case back for a new sentencing hearing, presumably in hopes that he can then file a motion to withdraw his guilty plea under a more lenient standard. That argument has at least four fatal flaws to it, and I think the Court today has hit on a fifth flaw in that argument. And I'd like to begin with actually that fifth flaw, because I, on brief, assumed without conceding that the Court could read the statute to mean the defendant's change in circumstances includes a family's willingness to pay. But, of course, we're not conceding that point. And if this Court were to rule in Mr. Reyes' favor, the Court would have to rule in that opinion that a family's willingness to pay for an attorney counts as a change of circumstances for the defendant. And I think this case illustrates why that would be a problematic interpretation of the statute and would lead to gamesmanship on the part of defendants and defendants' families.
Well, I think that for the plain language indicates that, but beyond that is the, it seems to me, in terms of its placement in the code and its overarching purpose, it's to protect taxpayers. So beyond plain language, which normally you stop there, but beyond that, it seems to me that interpretation draws extra force from that basic point, which is, well, you've got the money now, why should we, you know, pay for your lawyer? Well, he's still broke.
Correct, Your Honor. And I think on top of that, the result of allowing a family's decision, okay, well, now we've decided we'll pay for your attorney, the result of allowing that to constitute a change of the defendant's circumstances is that it inevitably leads to delays in the proceedings of the trial, and that costs the Commonwealth money, those delays that result. So in this case, in answer to Mr. Chief Justice, your question earlier as to why the Public Defender's Office is in this case, the reason was explained by Mr. Nord on page 95 of the appendix, and what he said in his motion there is he talked to Mr. Swedish after that sentencing hearing, and Mr. Swedish told him that the family decided never ended up paying the full retainer. And for that reason, then appointed counsel continued in the case. And so basically, if the family's decision on, you know, Tuesday, okay, we're going to pay now, constitutes a change in circumstances, the family could decide on Wednesday, well, we've changed our mind, we're not going to pay, and so now he's indigent again. And then Thursday could come in and say, well, we've changed our mind again, now we've decided we're going to pay.
Or worse, on Tuesday, the dad comes in and says, look, just tell the judge I'll pay.
Yes, sir.
And we'll talk about whether I really will pay on Wednesday.
Because what it appears that something similar actually happened in this case. The attorney came in and said, well, they finally paid the retainer, but then it turns out, we find out down the road, they hadn't ever paid that full retainer. So the change in circumstances actually had not occurred, even assuming you count the family's willingness to pay as a change in circumstances. So to rule in his favor, you would have to find that a family's coming into court and saying, well, we've decided we're going to pay, is enough to mandate a continuance of the case, and the court should not read the statute in that manner. I'd like to then circle back to one of the threshold questions in this case, which is that question of waiver. And I would submit to the court, as I argued on brief, that Mr. Swedish waived any assertion that Mr. Reyes was entitled to a mandatory continuance in this case when Mr. Swedish told the court that it, quote-unquote, would be fine if the court allowed him to file a motion to reconsider instead of continuing the case. And I think this case is controlled by this court's decision in Buchanan, which is a 1989 decision, where defense counsel in that case used the exact same phrase.
Is it really waiver, or is it more counsel's conceding that there's really no prejudice to doing the wrong thing here, Judge? I know you want to do this. I don't want you to do this. But I agree. It's not a big deal. I can file a motion. As long as you promise me you'll give it a hard look, I'm good with that. But that's... Is that technically waiver, or is it simply an acknowledgement there's no prejudice?
Well, I think it serves both purposes, Your Honor. So I do think it's relevant to the question of prejudice. I think if you read this court's decision in Buchanan, the question was whether or not the trial court had erred in not allowing the defendant's court-appointed psychiatrist to visit the scene of the crime with the defendant and the defendant's counsel. And what this court said in Buchanan, the court applied Rule 525 and looked back to the record and noticed where defense counsel had told the court that if you allow defense counsel and the defendant to go to the scene of the crime, and we'll talk to the psychiatrist later, quote-unquote, that would be fine. And this court applied Rule 25 in that case and said that that was waiver. We have the exact same set of circumstances here where defense counsel told the trial court that it, quote-unquote, would be fine to allow him to file a motion to reconsider instead of continuing the case. So I do think it constitutes waiver under 525. I also think it's relevant to the prejudice analysis because the person in the best position to determine whether or not prejudice occurred is the defendant's own counsel.
Maybe the better way to conceptualize it is not waiver of the right, it's waiver of a later argument that he's prejudiced.
Correct. It's a failure to preserve the argument that he had been making up to that point because he backed off that argument and said it would be fine to do something else.
With that dialogue in mind, you said you had five different reasons. That was your second one. You might want to move on to your third.
So the third argument that I'd like to make today in terms of the fatal flaw in their arguments, and this perhaps might be the narrowest and best grounds for resolving this case, is that the statute says that the court shall grant a reasonable continuance. And what Mr. Reyes has attempted to do on brief is to rewrite the statute to say that the trial court is required or shall grant a continuance of a reasonable length. If the General Assembly had said a continuance of reasonable length, then we would be in a different place here, and perhaps the court should have and was required to grant a continuance, but the only question is a question of how long. That's not, of course, what the General Assembly said. The General Assembly said a reasonable continuance. And the reason why we can know that those two phrases are different is because when the General Assembly wants to say a continuance of a reasonable length, they say it. In fact, the very same year that the General Assembly put the phrase reasonable continuance in 19.2-159.1, the General Assembly amended 19.2-231. And when they made that amendment, they inserted a phrase in terms of an amended indictment and said, if that amendment to an indictment operates as a surprise to the defendant, quote, he shall be entitled upon request to a continuance of the case for a reasonable time.
But you know, even to the strictest of textualists, if you say you have a right to a continuance, it implies something other than an unreasonable continuance.
Correct, Your Honor.
So, I mean, with or without the statutory compare and contrast, isn't it implied in the very use of the statutory language you have a right to a reasonable continuance? But if it's an unreasonable continuance, obviously no one would say that you have a right to an unreasonable continuance.
That's correct, Your Honor. I think by qualifying the word continuance with the word reasonable, it's clear that what the General Assembly intended to do was to say the court shall grant a continuance, but only if that continuance is reasonable.
So what do you do with the Court of Appeals interpretation, which is based, frankly, on our prior cases, so it's not something they came up with on their own, that needs to be more than a reasonable reason. It has to be some extreme circumstance.
Well, I think the reason why the Court of Appeals relied on that exceptional circumstances language from this court's Sixth Amendment case law is because the timing of the motion for continuance in this case. Because the continuance motion was filed the day before that sentencing hearing, it was a last-minute request for a continuance. In the Sixth Amendment context, what the courts have said is that if there's a last-minute request for a continuance, then the defendant has to show something more than just the usual, you know, his usual reasons for wanting a continuance.
So the logic there is, if the constitutional right to counsel and thus a continuance upon a late appointed counsel requires some pretty extreme circumstances if it's made really late, a fortiori some statutory right, whatever it is, including one that's really just an adjunct to a public fisc provision, should as well.
Right, Your Honor. And I think if you want to read what the Court of Appeals said in terms of fitting into the statute, what the Court of Appeals was essentially doing was coming up with, okay, how do we analyze whether or not a trial court's decision to grant a continuance was reasonable? How do we analyze whether or not giving a continuance to this defendant would have been a reasonable thing to do? And one of the ways that you analyze that is you look, okay, what was the timing of the request? Was it made, you know, weeks, months in advance of the next court date, or was it made at the very last minute? And here, the request was made at the very last minute. So when you have that on one side of the equation, then it makes sense to require the defendant to show some sort of exceptional circumstances in order to establish that a continuance in this case would have been reasonable. So absent his ability to do that, he is not shown that a continuance would have been reasonable, and therefore the court was not required to grant a continuance.
I know the case had been continued once before as the defendant was looking for some programs or a program, and I know the victim had, you know, to reappear. But this is not a case where, at least as far as the record shows, where there was distant travel for the victim, or there was a whole slew of witnesses whose lives was going to be disrupted. So isn't that on the other side of the ledger, which is, well, how is really the Commonwealth or the process hurt all that much?
I do think you had, and the trial court was trying to balance factors that weighed on both sides of the ledger. So you didn't have a case where you had, you know, 10, 15, 20 witnesses coming. You didn't have a case where you had out-of-state witnesses. This is true. But you also didn't have a case where the request was made weeks or months in advance of the hearing. You had a case where the request was made at the very last minute the day before. This also wasn't
in the
case
face of a prior.
In the face of the prior request for a continuance,
and
which was also last minute.
If the standard is abuse of discretion and it's a reasonable judgment call, then it's game over.
Correct, Your Honor. And this court only assesses whether or not a reasonable trial court could have come to the conclusion that this trial court came to. So for those reasons.
I was trying to think where else in the code there is anything like this. And I don't have it in front of me. Maybe you can answer the question. Maybe you can't. But in mid-trial, if the Commonwealth moves to amend the indictment, the defendant has a right to a continuance. Are there any conditions to that right?
I haven't read the case law on that, Your Honor, but the statute says he shall be entitled upon request to a continuance of the case for a reasonable time. So the limitation that the General Assembly put in that statute seems to be that the length of the continuance is what must have to be reasonable.
That seems to support your view that this is different.
It does, Your Honor, because the language the General Assembly used in 192.159.1, again, the exact same session of the General Assembly. So the rule would have applied regardless of whether it was a different session. But in 1975, the General Assembly also amended our statute and said a reasonable continuance. So this court has to assume that they meant different things by choosing different phrases.
But, you know, even in the indictment and in the change of the indictment language and not matching up with the facts, prejudice is still required for appellate. You can find a violation, but prejudice is still required for appellate reversal.
Correct, Your Honor.
So it's like you have two tiers of responses to that scenario. One is it's not our statutory provision, and even that statutory provision, prejudice is required for reversal, albeit even in the situation where the right was technically violated.
That's correct, Your Honor. And so that was, I think, the third of the 4 points I was hoping to make today, which is that even if the court were to assume that there were an abuse of discretion, the court would still have to find that he was prejudiced by the trial court's failure to grant him a continuance. What he's tried to argue on appeal is that, well, the prejudice was that he didn't get the counsel that he wanted. However, this is not a Sixth Amendment case. It's not even a case where
arguing a little more than that, because they're saying there was a motion, but it was sloppily done. There wasn't a investigator requested, there wasn't an alibi pursued, and then the motion that was filed was just phoning it in, basically. It wasn't, you know, properly developed. So it's a little more than just, well, I was entitled to this lawyer and I didn't get him.
Right, so there are two parts to their prejudice argument. The first part is that they were entitled to the attorney of their choice and didn't get the attorney that they wanted. That argument fails, of course, because the trial court told Mr. Swedish, you're more than welcome to come into the case and to co-represent Mr. Reyes here at sentencing and to file any motions subsequent to this that you'd like to. And Mr. Swedish said, that's okay, I'm going to withdraw that motion. I have court somewhere else, I'm not going to get in the case. And then the retainer was never paid, so he never came in. So he was not denied by the trial court the right to have the attorney he wanted. The attorney just made the decision not to get into the case, and the family made a decision never to pay the attorney. As to the second portion of the prejudice argument, you know, they argue that, well, the attorney that they had basically could have done a better job. And they speculate that if he had done a better job, perhaps they would have been successful in getting that motion to withdraw the plea granted. First of all, anything that they're arguing about, well, the attorney didn't do an adequate investigation, and that's why we were prejudiced by the failure to get the continuance. That investigation had occurred to the extent that it did.
Why is it relevant anyway? At the time the trial judge made the call, he couldn't predict that the attorney would make a lousy motion to reconsider. I mean, how could we possibly fault the trial judge for taking into account failing to take into account the motion to reconsider may not be good enough later?
Right.
Even if it were completely messed up, and even if it was something that either attorney could have been culpable for messing up, I don't know how the trial judge is responsible for that.
I don't think it's relevant to assessing whether or not the trial court made any sort of error in this case, because like you said, the trial court cannot anticipate what might come afterwards. If anything, it might be relevant to whether or not he was prejudiced by the trial court's decision not to grant that continuance. But again, any argument that he'd done an inadequate investigation, that all took place before he entered the Alford plea. When he entered the Alford plea, he waived any arguments that his trial court hadn't been performing adequately up to that. So what we look at, the court looks at in terms of prejudice, was how was he prejudiced by not getting a delay in his sentencing hearing? And under that analysis, the record clearly shows that he was not prejudiced because counsel filed a motion to withdraw his guilty plea. And admittedly, there weren't a whole lot of reasons given in that first motion that was filed. But Mr. Reyes never made a clear proffer that he had good reasons for wanting to withdraw that guilty plea. Even under the more lenient standard, he never made a proffer that he inadvisedly entered that guilty plea in the first place. The best he could say is, well, he had a witness who was willing to come in and say that he was at a certain place at a certain time, and that now he wants to change his mind and he wants his shot at trial. These courts have said that is not an adequate grounds for withdrawing a guilty plea.
Let me ask you one final question, even though your time has expired. I don't know that this makes any difference, but neither party actually challenges the circuit court's order, which is surprising, but maybe it's because it doesn't make any difference. The order recites that the trial court granted the motion to substitute Charles Swedish as counsel, and the trial court didn't do any such thing. That didn't happen. And then it says that the trial court ordered that attorney Roger Nord be withdrawn from this case, and that further attorney Charles Swedish represent the defendant in this case. That did not happen on the transcript of this case. It goes on and further talks about how there was having said you're now the new lawyer, the new lawyer was then relieved of the responsibility, and the old lawyer was reappointed. That didn't happen. So is there any significance to the order of the trial court that is at least part fiction in how we resolve this case?
I think the court is certainly correct. If the trial court did not make any of those rulings explicitly on the record as I read the record. However, we also know from this court's case law that a court speaks through its written orders. And so in terms of resolving what's in the transcript and what the court said in its order, I think the best way perhaps to read that written order is that the court was thinking back to what happened at the hearing and what in the court's mind occurred at the hearing. And what the court determined in writing that order is that by allowing Mr. Swedish to argue the motion for the continuance, what the court had essentially allowed Mr. Swedish to do was to come into the case to represent Mr. Reyes for that portion of the hearing, to make his argument as to why the continuance motion should be granted, and then when the continuance motion was not granted, to then withdraw from the case and back out. And so I think it was the trial court trying to reconcile what it believed had happened on the record and putting that in an order explicitly. The only relevance, I think, to resolving this case on appeal, if any, is the fact that just further demonstrates that Mr. Reyes was not denied his right to the counsel of his choice. That in the court's mind, the court allowed him to be represented.
During that interregnum, as recited by the trial judge, was the defendant represented by retained counsel?
But what is the court's question? I'm sorry.
Well, if you read the sentencing order, it appears that the defendant was represented by retained counsel at least for that period of time. But I don't see that in the transcript. And I'm just wondering if you're right that we go by the trial court's orders and nobody's challenged it, was he actually represented by retained counsel?
I think that in the court's mind in writing that order, it appears that the court believed he was actually represented by retained counsel, at least to argue the motion for continuance. And that's all the more reason why this court should affirm.
It seems as though the court was making a deal, back and forth, working out a problem reasonably. And the order may be literally a little aggressive, but it sort of represents the takeaway the trial judge had.
I think that's correct, Your Honor. And for all of these reasons, unless there are further questions from the court.
All right. Thank you very much. Call the next case.